Thank you, Brent, and thank you, Dick, so much for the conversation and the large view of the state of American journalism that identifies the local challenges so well. You talked about how journalism uncovers facts, and you talked about the crisis in the advertising supported model of journalism, but a lot of Americans would say there's liberal bias that's another problem in American journalism. And I wonder if you agree with that, especially coming from the Wall Street Journal, if you've over the years thought there's a liberal bias and that to regain credibility, you need to emphasize stories that might convince people in the midsection of the country that there's not a liberal bias.
So it's a really good question. I don't think there is a liberal bias in the press. I do think there are biases in all of us in almost everything we do. And the most important ones are shaped by where you come from and who you know and your own life experiences. So I do not think it is a great thing for this country that most of the national press is in New York and a good bit of the rest is in Washington. I think the country would be better off. At one point, I wrote a biography of the guy who founded the modern Wall Street Journal. At one point, he thought about moving the journal to Chicago, and I actually think the country would be better off if he'd done that. One of the reasons that we are so interested in the local reporting network is if you look at our site, I hope now in the last 2 years that you'll see a real mix of where stories are coming from and the communities where people think those stories are important. Almost everyone in our New York office lives in Brooklyn. The idea that a group of people who live only in Brooklyn could see the country whole, I think is hard to swallow, hard to sell. So I like the fact that a lot of the story ideas, most of them at this point, are coming from around the country. But I don't think that there are, in good journalism, a lot of people who wake up and say, you know, what we got to do here is promote a set of specific policy beliefs. I don't think that's the way it works. And, you know, let's be honest, right? I mean, the country at the moment is run by someone who at least claims to be a conservative and certainly at the moment is a Republican, although if you look at his history, he used to be a Democrat and he used to be a liberal, right? But what he really is a guy who grew up in Queens and lived on 57th Street his whole life. So American conservatism is much of it being run from the same, you know, more Manhattan than Brooklyn, more Chevy Chase than downtown in the district, but I don't regard that as awesome diversity either.
It's a little hard to talk about in this beautiful, peaceful spot, but we live in an increasingly dangerous world, as we've recently witnessed. As an enemy of the people, you're probably one of the targets. Are you scared? Does ProPublica scared? What do they do about it? Are there stories about threats or anything? And you put yourself in a vulnerable position, and as I say, it's hard to even talk about. But love to hear.
No, it's fair. I'm not scared. My wife gets anxious a little sometimes. I'm really not. And, you know, compared to lots of other people who are putting things on the line for the country, you know, starting with people who serve in the armed services, I mean, you know, the risks we're taking are really trivial, honestly, compared to those millions of people for a start, or first responders, or if people aren't going to do anything about it, at this point, school teachers. I mean, you know, we've got a receptionist, you know, in our building, and they check people's IDs and stuff like that. I mean, you know, it's a heck of a lot easier to get into school buildings. So, so no, at that level, some of our reporters, little bit, one who spent the last few years covering white supremacy, those are crazy people, and they started to do some crazy stuff. But I think we can take adequate precautions about that, and we check with him to make sure he's comfortable with them. And
so you're not afraid of I mean, you guys wrote a story about Ivanka Trump getting special treatment for her products and changed her special treatment. So you're poking the president. That doesn't intimidate you at all?
No. My academic study as a young person was political science. It was about the presidency of the United States more than anything. My academic mentor was a guy named Richard Neustadt, who some of you may know his work. And I was very fortunate. I worked in the White House when I was 19 years old, and again when I was 22 years old, I think. The presidency of the United States, the closer you get to it, the more you understand it, is a much weaker office than it appears. People should not be intimidated about going up against, you know, disagreeing with the President of the United States. In my judgment, our history is filled with people who can go toe-to-toe with presidents, pretty much every one of the 44 of them, and win.
It probably helps he's just another guy from Queens, and you're from New York, so what the heck.
I just have sort of an obvious question, and it's about fake news, which is, you know, we have now this very dangerous and very powerful strategy of labeling anything that's critical of the administration, the administration's policies, or of Trump personally as fake news. It's kind of very simple, very brilliant. It's been done historically before, but do you all at ProPublica, do you really think carefully and strategically about how to fight that? I mean, how do you push against that? How do you reach people who think that everything that you might do is fake news?
Yeah, I actually don't think people think that in real life. I think my views about this trust problem, if I can, you know, sort of slightly change the question to a question about trust in journalism. So you see all sorts of surveys that say trust in journalism is collapsing. Trust in every institution in our society is collapsing. And I'm not arguing with the surveys. I'm sure people say that. I actually think it's a lot like the responses about members of Congress, which is everyone hates the Congress. But most members get elected, reelected time after time after time. And the surveys actually show, if you ask, most people like their own member of Congress. And last fall, we had this huge earthquake. I mean, historically speaking, it was a considerable earthquake in the congressional elections. A considerable earthquake means that 10% of the Congress lost their jobs. That's an earthquake. I think it's the same in news media, which is people don't trust the news media, but they trust the media that they themselves read. And what I find is when we can reveal facts, very often, not always, but very often, it still spurs considerable change. And over time, I have yet to see a large phenomenon in which you expose people to the facts about something they truly felt was important and that it did not change. Now, it takes time. And you have to, you know, this brings you back to the thing that President Obama used to talk about all the time, about the arc of history. I very much believe that, but, you know, sometimes it does bend slowly. But look, even, for instance, in the gun debate, where the overwhelming majority of the country has felt one way for a long time, the lobby on the other side would appear to be collapsing. What will be the consequence of that? I think it's much too soon to tell, but I think it will be. I think it will be meaningful. Yes, down here.
Young people today have an increasing number of career options, and I wonder: do you ever worry about the talent pipeline into American journalism? If not, what bright spots do you see? If so, what levers do you see?
Or if your children came home and said they were going to major in journalism, would it crush you?
I worry about this a lot. I worry about it a lot because. So the business is shrinking, so, you know, in that sense, from a macroeconomic point of view, we don't need to attract as many people. so there seems to still be an enormous oversupply of talented people. So I don't quite worry about that. What I do worry about is we're losing the pathways through which people were trained. And that is a very significant problem. There, local journalism, it wasn't that nobody stayed in local journalism, but the leaders of national journalism all started in local journalism once upon a time. I remember when I was in college, I went to see Tom Wicker speak, who had been the White House correspondent for the New York Times, and at that point was writing a column for the New York Times. And I thought, well, he's got pretty much the greatest job there ever was, so I'll, you know, they tell you when you're in college, go see these people who have these great jobs and figure out how they got to be who they were. So I go. Tom Wicker started by writing about minor league baseball in North Carolina for 3 years. So that's great, but here's the bad news. There's no pathway from writing about minor league baseball in North Carolina to being the White House correspondent of the New York Times anymore. Because you can't, nobody can afford to send anybody to cover minor league baseball in North Carolina. So that worries me a lot. Yes.
Does the fact that you're a nonprofit in any way constrain the things that you publish,
or is it an advantage?
So it's a fair question. I hope the answer is no. I want to say there are a few things that no news organization covers well. No news organization covers itself very well. So this is mostly compensated for in journalism by the fact that journalists are so incredibly self-obsessed that everybody in journalism covers everybody else all the time. But then, you know, would we be the best people or the most likely people to spot a systemic problem in institutional foundations? We might not, honestly. And if we were all that was left of journalism, that's an important power center in our society. On the other hand, best news organizations have never worried about their commercial interests. At the Journal, for instance, this guy I wrote about, Barney Kilgore, really made the Wall Street Journal, the modern Wall Street Journal. The key moment was when in 1954 he went up against General Motors, which was the largest company in the country and the leading advertiser in the Journal, and wrote some stuff about them that they hated and stuck to his guns and won, and it really put the Journal on the map in a way it hadn't been before. So, we've got a piece coming very soon about one of the three or four people, richest people in the country, that I think you'll see is a courageous piece of journalism. So I don't really worry about that very much.
So you're doing what Aspen Journalism does, which is to alienate one donor at a time kind of thing? So.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a big country, and hopefully we'll run out of people we've alienated before we run out of support, yeah. Down here in front.
I follow Trump Inc., which I think is fabulous and compelling reporting. And I was wondering, has ProPublica been threatened with lawsuits and regarding that? And if they haven't, does that concern you?
Does it concern me that we haven't? So first of all, I should say for everybody else, Trump Inc. is a podcast we do with our partners at WNYC about the president's personal business and sort of related subjects. We have not been threatened with a libel suit about that. We do hear from people who are unhappy with our work all the time. I spent some time dealing with a company that was unhappy about a story we'd written just today. It doesn't worry me, in part because I think one of two things could happen. Either when you're not being threatened, you're either not being tough enough, that's possible, or you've really got it cold. And I think there are a number of those stories that have been plenty tough. I mean, I hope you agree, if you're still listening, you probably do agree about, for instance, the Trump Hotel in Panama, Sheldon Adelson's business interests. Sheldon Adelson does sue people for libel, and I don't think he could have reasonably been happy with our stories about him.
You have been sued, and you wrote about that in your recent newsletter, and one of them cost you a great deal of money, and it's been a concern of mine, frankly, that if we don't do a good enough job, if we don't have it cold, then someone could sue us, and even if they lose, destroy us. And so it helps to be well-armored with having enough money and good attorneys to defend yourself. But
yeah,
how serious a threat is that to you? Could you be taken down by a persistent libel suit?
Not if we hadn't made a terrible mistake, honestly. We're very fortunate, and I tried to say this in the column, we have the most pro-press laws of any major country in the world in this country. I think it's one of the great blessings of liberty we have in this country, and we've had it for 55 years now. And there seems no move to stop it. Justice Thomas is opposed to it, but when he said that in an opinion this spring, nobody joined him, not even Gorsuch or Kavanaugh. So I think I don't see any prospect of that law changing. The law provides that if you knowingly publish something that is not true, that is harmful to somebody, that you will lose. And frankly, in my judgment, you should. It's expensive. It's probably about to get much more expensive. I wish that weren't true, but it's a cost of doing business, and I think one that we, with people's support, can manage.
The truth is still the best defense, then.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Let's see, all the way in the back.
How have you dealt with or thought about the, I don't know if it's a dilemma or not, but the issue of covering, you know, kind of just the drama coming out of the White House, for lack of a better word, versus the policies, and both can be important, but I think sometimes, you know, at least I've read opinions that, you know, if there's too much focus on the drama, you miss the important policies. Have you guys talked about that from an editorial perspective?
We talk about it a lot. This Washington initiative that we've just started is an attempt to try to deal with that. We really want to cover the policies of the government, particularly outside of the Justice Department and the Congress and the State Department, which I think are the parts of the government that are well covered, and spend our time in that effort on the Department of Housing and Urban Development, the Department of Health and Human Services, the Department of Agriculture, that nobody is paying any attention to at this point, which I think can be really troubling. We wrote a piece about Secretary Carson's record, for instance, at HUD, and we've done a lot about public housing around this country, which I think is extraordinarily troubling. And you look at the tariffs and the way they've been implemented, and we haven't really gotten into this yet, but my guess is that if you pried the lid off the Department of Agriculture at this point, the number of things that would run fleeing from the light would be extraordinary. Did I have a, yes, right back in the back.
How has your approach to stories changed over the years in terms of where you look for stories and how you go about investigating them?
I suppose another way to phrase that is, what makes a ProPublica story a ProPublica story? How do you know it's for you?
Yeah, what we try to look for and focus on is an abuse of power, betrayal of the public trust, either by government or business or some other powerful private interest. In some ways, not terribly, but there have been three broad periods. We started in business before the crash, and so the crash of the fall of 2008 really led us to revise our news agenda quite a lot. And in the years after that, the 3 or 4 years after that, the news agenda shifted quite a lot, and we tried to go with that. And the election of 2016 was the next moment, and we tried to shift our news agenda to follow that in a lot of different ways, which is not so much about the president personally, but about a different set of public concerns. And I think one of the most important things to do as a news organization is to stay nimble and see those moments, not to see one every 5 minutes, because there aren't moments like that every 5 minutes. But when there is, you know, a once in a decade news transformation, to see it and to go with it. Yes, over here.
To go back to your question about your previous comment about the law, is a tweet considered publication?
Yes.
Okay, so if this current occupant of the White House has so many absolute falsehoods in tweets, why is, if he's not been sued for that, why not?
That's a good question. Well, first of all, you have to prove that he is subjectively aware that what he is saying is untrue. And then you'd have to, it would have to be defamatory of somebody and would have to diminish their reputation. They have to have some damages. I have no doubt that if you went back through all those tweets, that there are some that would meet those tests, but probably not many, because opinion is protected, which I think is a good thing and should be. If you are not, so if you're just spouting off your opinions, even including your hateful opinions, that's not actionable. It's really, you've got to make up facts. So for instance, when the president says, you know, Elijah Cummings' district is rat infested, well, there are some rat-infested places in Elijah Cummings' district, right? And second of all, even if there weren't any, I'm not sure it's defamatory of Elijah Cummings personally to say that his district is rat-infested. And cities can't sue. So, you know, as I say, we have very protective libel laws in this country. And on balance, I think we should all be quite happy about that.
Plus, he's an elected official. So your inquisition is almost over, Mr. Toffel. We'll take two more questions.
Okay, why don't we go back there and then over here.
Hey, thanks so much, Dick, for coming and Brent for hosting.
Thank you. This is great.
I have a very micro two-person ProPublica on the Front Range in Boulder called the Story Group. That's just two of us, and we do investigative environmental stories. And we watch the collapse of the economic model in journalism along the Front Range, as everybody who lives there knows. The journalism landscape there has been gutted and reposed as a shell, and there are struggling online publications there. And we work in similar ways you do. We get donations through a nonprofit to do our work. But for our size, you guys are like the New York Times to us being like the Tiny. For our size, it's just not a sustainable economic model. And we have the stories, we have the places to publish, we have the talent, we just have a hard time finding funding if we want to stay small. And I was wondering what your advice would be to groups like ours, local groups, that are journalists that are trying to do investigative work to fill the gaps that are out there now. What's the best way forward economically to be able to survive, whether it's collaborations, and do you see a new economic model eventually rising out of this?
I think this is, to some extent, you know, I obviously don't know the situation in Boulder, but I will just say, I think that ultimately this is a dialogue you really need to have with your community. You may be right that paradoxically it would be easier to support if it were bigger. You know, one of the reasons I was thrilled to come out here, because I've watched with great interest what Brent and his colleagues have done at Aspen Journalism now for a decade. I think this kind of thing can make an enormous difference in a community like this. We got here on Sunday afternoon, and on Monday morning in the Times on page 3, Heather has a fabulous story about an important issue relating to water in the community that I suspect wouldn't otherwise exist. People who care about communities ultimately need to decide that that's important enough that it'll be on the list of things they want to support in their community. Not the only one. But I would argue that with what's going on with journalism, just like you want to have a great hospital, and you want to have a great art museum, and you want to have, you know, some theater, and you want to have some other things, and you want to have, you know, educational institutions that lift the place up, you need some public interest journalism to keep a community vibrant, to keep it self-regulating, to keep it able to govern itself in a democratic way. And I hope this community will do that. You're all being here this afternoon is some evidence that it will. But I think that is ultimately you've got to relegate that to a dialogue, to a real engagement process between journalists and their communities.
I would say, given that David Krause, the editor of the Aspen Times, is in the room, it's also incredibly valuable to have a newspaper to collaborate with and make sure
Heather's
story has a vehicle. So, all right, one more. I should close right after that. That was beautiful.
Over here.
How do you contrast today's journalistic atmosphere with that of the Yellow Press in the 1890s?
So it's a good question. I would say the standards of accuracy in the highest levels of the press are much higher. But there are, Pulitzer and Hearst are not role models. I mean, it's an enormous irony that the highest honor in American journalism is named after Joseph Pulitzer, who bought his way out of the Civil War and, did his best with his arch rival Hearst to get us into the Spanish-American War, through, leading to pretty much no good for anybody. But there have always been high and low press in this country. The best press, the best journalism in this country, I think today, is better than there's ever been. And I actually would say the worst is not the worst it's ever been. I think that Fox News and this may annoy some of you, MSNBC are both sort of a blight on the national copybook, and frankly, most of CNN. I think President Obama's advice to spend your mornings when you're exercising watching ESPN is good advice. If you don't like sports, watch the Travel Channel. But that stuff, which is, a wasteland and worse, it's not as bad, honestly, as the press of the 1790s, which was far worse, far worse. That was a press that was given to us, among other people, by Madison and Jefferson. So, who also gave us the press protections that make the country in many ways what I think it is today.
One of the watchwords in our organization is that well-informed citizens make better decisions. And so I just want to thank all of you citizens for coming out. And Dick, thank you very much for all your time and expertise.